Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Okay, let's unpack this fascinating, infuriating, and architecturally beautiful place. Oh. Washington, D.C.
Right.
Most people picture the monuments, you know, the marble halls of power, the White House, that iconic image. But what we really have here, based on the source material you shared with us, is a city born of a political deal.
Completely. And it's burdened by a constitutional mandate and perpetually struggling to find its own voice while being, you know, the definitive voice of the nation.
It's a paradox forged in granite and law.
It truly is a study in contradictions. Our source material provides a comprehensive blueprint, and it details how DC's meticulously planned physical structure and its, well, its turbulent political status have shaped it from a swampy compromise into this global political, economic, and cultural nexus.
Yeah. We aren't just looking at the federal capital.
No. We're looking at a densely populated, living city that has been fundamentally constrained by its role since the very beginning.
And that's the mission right there. Understanding the city, not just the capital. Mm. Our deep dive is set to cover its dramatic history, a story of burning and retrocession and rebirth.
And its utterly unique and often absurd political structure, which is really defined by a lack of local control.
Plus the powerhouse economy that flows around the government and the vibrant, often overlooked culture that exists so far beyond the National Mall.
And the big question that ties all this together for you, the listener, is this. How does a federal district created specifically for national security and political compromise under exclusive congressional jurisdiction?
Right.
How does it manage to balance the crushing demands of global power and federal operations with the fundamental needs and democratic rights of its own local Washingtonian residents?
That tension.
That tension has defined every single major turning point in DC's history, starting right at the very founding.
So let's start at the very beginning, because D.C. was never supposed to be just another city. It was a political necessity. The founders, they explicitly wrote a requirement for it right into the Constitution.
They did. And this necessity, it stemmed directly from a really painful experience. The establishment of a federal district was mandated by Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution.
And that required a district under exclusive congressional jurisdiction.
Right.
Not exceeding 10 miles square.
Exactly. And this was a direct response to what happened in 1783 with the Pennsylvania Mutiny. Sometimes it's called the Philadelphia Mutiny.
Remind us of that incident, because it sounds like the founders were deeply scarred by it.
Oh, they absolutely were. In 1783, you had Revolutionary War soldiers, unpaid and angry, who surrounded the State House in Philadelphia where the Congress was meeting.
And they were trapped.
Essentially. Congress requested protection from the Pennsylvania state government, but the state refused to mobilize its militia.
So Congress had to just flee.
They were forced to flee Philadelphia and relocate to Princeton, New Jersey. The framers realized right then that the new federal government could not be dependent on the willingness of a state government to protect it or even allow it to operate.
So absolute, exclusive federal authority over the capital was deemed non-negotiable for the security of the whole republic.
That was the logic. So establishing the need for a district was easy. Establishing the location was, well, that was the result of one of the great backroom political bargains of the early republic.
The Compromise of 1790.
That's where the high-stakes drama occurred. The northern states, led by Alexander Hamilton, they wanted the federal government to assume the collective Revolutionary War debts of all the states.
And the southern states were not having it.
Not at all. Led by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, they heavily resisted this measure. They saw it as giving way too much power to the federal center.
But the South wanted the capital.
Exactly. And that was the key trade-off. It was brokered during a famous dinner meeting, which is documented in our sources. It was a political bargain.
So what was the deal?
Southern representatives would vote to allow the federal assumption of state debts, which would stabilize the national credit. That was Hamilton's key priority, in exchange for locating the new national capital in the South.
Specifically, along the Potomac River.
Right. The Residence Act formalized this location, establishing the 100 square miles of the district and marking July 16, 1790 as the official founding date.
So the initial federal district was this perfect 10-mile by 10-mile square, 100 square miles total, with land ceded from both Maryland and Virginia. But this wasn't empty wilderness, was it?
No, not at all. The territory already included two established colonial port cities, Georgetown, which was founded in 1751 on the Maryland side, and Alexandria, Virginia, founded in 1749 on the Virginia side.
So the challenge was integrating these existing areas while designing a new monumental core.
And the initial surveying of this new territory in 1791 was itself a historically significant endeavor.
It must have been a huge technical task for the time.
A massive one, led by Andrew Ellicott. Our sources highlight the crucial inclusion of Benjamin Banneker, the African-American astronomer and polymath who worked on the surveying team.
And his involvement is so important.
It really is. It underscores that the city's intellectual foundation, just like its physical foundation, was complexly tied to the dynamics of race and labor from day one.
And speaking of names, they settled on the city of Washington and the District of Columbia. That's just classic American symbolism.
Very much so. The city itself was named on September 9th, 1791, in honor of President George Washington, and the district was named Columbia.
Which was the popular, poetic, sort of female personification of the young United States.
Right, a blend of classical ideals and national ambition.
And this ambition is where Pierre Charles L'Enfant comes in. He designed a capital meant to impress, one that rivaled the European seats of power. He was drawing direct inspiration from places like Versailles and the Tuileries Gardens.
L'Enfant's 1791 plan was truly a statement of intent for the new republic. He didn't just want a grid. He wanted a system that was efficient, beautiful, and also defensible.
And his vision included those iconic broad streets and diagonal avenues radiating out from circles and rectangles.
Yes, and those diagonals were vital. They connected the major focal points, the Capitol and the future White House. They ensured clear sight lines for defense, and they maximized open space.
Laying the groundwork for what would become the vast National Mall.
Exactly. He had a genius plan, but he clearly lacked political finesse.
That's the tragic tale of L'Enfant, isn't it?
It is. He had the grand vision, but he clashed constantly with the commissioners overseeing the construction. He viewed their practical concerns as beneath his artistic temperament.
And Washington eventually just had enough.
George Washington dismissed him in March 1792. Andrew Ellicott finished the design, revising some street patterns for practicality, though L'Enfant justly retains the credit for the overwhelming monumental quality of the final blueprint.
As we admire that grand vision, though, we have to look directly at the critical dark detail that permeated the foundation of the city.
We do.
D.C.'s development was explicitly reliant on slave labor.
Absolutely. When the land was ceded, both Maryland and Virginia were slave states, and the laws governing slavery continued to operate in the district. The immense physical labor required for the monumental construction.
Leveling the ground, quarrying stone.
Building the Capitol and the White House. It all relied significantly on enslaved and free black laborers. Furthermore, as a capital located between major slave states, D.C. quickly became a central node in the nation's brutal internal slave trade.
It established itself as an important slave market.
A very important one, right up until the Compromise of 1850.
That initial compromise and expansion faced its first existential threat very early on, the crisis of 1814 during the War of 1812.
This was the dramatic burning of Washington, a massive national humiliation. Following their victory over American forces at the Battle of Bladensburg, British troops occupied the city on August 24, 1814.
And they were seeking retaliation for American destruction in Canada, right?
That's right. They marched into the city and systematically set fire to the core federal buildings.
The White House and the Capitol were both gutted, correct?
Yeah, gutted. The White House was burned, forcing the quick evacuation of its occupants, and the capital, which was still unfinished, was severely damaged.
But what's fascinating, and adds this layer of almost divine intervention to the story, is that the occupation only lasted for 24 hours.
It's an incredible detail. The British were forced to evacuate by a severe, sudden storm. It was possibly a hurricane or a major tornado, which extinguished the fires, but also caused more destruction to the city than the British troops themselves.
So the weather system basically saved the capital from a prolonged occupation and even more damage.
It's a remarkable historical footnote.
The city recovered, it rebuilt, but the next major event reshaped the district permanently, the 1846 retrocession. This is where the original 100 square miles went down to the size we recognize today.
This was a pivotal moment, and it was driven by fear and economics. The territory south of the Potomac, which included the city of Alexandria, had been declining economically relative to the growing northern parts of the district.
So residents felt neglected by congressional management.
They did. But the decisive factor was politics, specifically the politics of slavery.
They were afraid of Congress abolishing slavery in the district.
Precisely. Pro-slavery residents in Alexandria feared that abolitionist pressure in Congress would eventually lead the federal government to use its exclusive jurisdiction to outlaw slavery.
So by petitioning to be returned to Virginia, a slave state, they believed they could safeguard the institution.
Right. Virginia voted to accept the land back in February 1846, and Congress formalized the retrocession on July 9, 1846, returning all the territory Virginia had ceded.
And as you mentioned, their fears were confirmed shortly thereafter.
But hey, by reducing the district's size, the anti-slavery forces in the remaining smaller D.C. gained greater political influence.
And then came the Compromise of 1850.
Which soon outlawed the slave trade within the reduced district. And then in 1862, the Compensated Emancipation Act freed about 3,100 slaves, making D.C. one of the first jurisdictions to eliminate slavery.
And this was months before the National Emancipation Proclamation.
Yes. The move also served as a crucial test case for federal intervention in slavery.
The Civil War brought explosive growth to the city, followed by a major political reorganization designed to manage that rapid expansion.
The war cemented D.C.'s status. It led to a massive expansion of the federal government and a population boom, driven notably by a large influx of freed slaves seeking opportunity and security.
The population swelled by 75% in a single decade.
It was huge. But this growth resulted in a city with terrible sanitation, unpaved streets, and inadequate infrastructure. This chaotic growth led Congress to pass the pivotal Organic Act of 1871.
This act sounds bureaucratic, but the critique rightly points out it's where D.C.'s modern identity and its struggles really begin.
It is the moment D.C. lost its local democratic rights for a century. The Organic Act of 1871 was designed to create order. It abolished the separate charters for the cities of Washington and Georgetown, and it abolished Washington County.
And it created a single, new territorial government for the entire District of Columbia.
Crucially, it put this new territorial government under the direct control of a federally appointed governor and board.
So local elections were suspended.
Effectively, yes. The source material states that after this, the city of Washington became legally indistinguishable from the District of Columbia, a unified municipality, but the local democratic structure was just gone.
The entire district was consolidated into one political entity managed by federal appointees.
And that action set the stage for the century-long fight for self-governance. It is the historical root of the political paradox D.C. faces today. Congress had established its capital and then stripped the residents of their ability to govern it themselves.
That historical context is so crucial because it shows that for D.C., home rule is a concession, not a right. The foundational mandate from Article 1, Section 8, that exclusive congressional jurisdiction, it never went away.
Never. It simply defines the city's entire political existence.
It's the ultimate legal lever.
It is. Even after D.C. finally regained a measure of self-governance with the Home Rule Act of 1973, which was a major victory for the city, Congress retains the ultimate inherent power.
So every local law, the entire budget, it's all still subject to congressional review.
And potentially a legislative veto or intervention.
let's detail the current local governance structure that resulted from that 1973 act. It's a hybrid system.
It is. The system now includes an elected mayor, currently Muriel Bowser, who serves as the chief executive. Legislative power rests with the 13-member council of the District of Columbia.
And that council includes 8 members elected from specific geographic wards, 4 at-large members representing the whole district, and an at-large chair.
Right, which allows for broad representation across the city.
But the hyper-local democracy, the layer beneath the council, is what I find fascinating. The Advisory Neighborhood Commissions, or ANCs.
The ANCs are a unique and robust feature of DC governance. There are 37 of them, and they are elected by very small neighborhood districts. They are purely advisory.
But the Home Rule Act mandates that government agencies have to give their advice careful consideration.
And that's the key. They have to consider it before taking action on everything from zoning changes to liquor licenses. It forces the local government to engage with residents at the grassroots level.
Which provides an extraordinary degree of civic input that you just don't often see in large U.S. cities.
No, you don't.
But it sounds like a thriving local democracy. But structurally, the government is hobbled when it comes to money. We have to dive deeper into this structural deficit mentioned in the critique.
Yes, because this is where the political paradox hits the pavement. This is the core financial injustice. DC operates under an inherent structural deficit that analysts estimate runs between $470 million to over $1 billion annually.
$1 billion. And that's caused by 2 fundamental constraints imposed by the federal government.
That's right. The first being federal property.
Of course. Vast portions of DC's most valuable land. The National Mall, the Federal Triangle, major parks, all the federal buildings themselves.
They're federally owned and thus completely tax exempt.
But the city still has to provide police, fire, sanitation, and infrastructure services to all that property.
Right, but it receives 0 property tax revenue from it.
And the second, and I'd argue more infuriating constraint for residents, is the ban on the commuter tax.
Precisely. Every day, hundreds of thousands of commuters pour in from Maryland and Virginia to work in D.C. They use city services, roads, police.
But Congress prohibits the district from levying a commuter tax.
A mechanism that is common in cities like New York or Philadelphia. The prohibition stems from the political fear that surrounding states would retaliate by imposing taxes on D.C. residents working there, leading to a regional tax war.
So how does D.C. make up that deficit? What's the real-world pain point for residents?
The city has to rely on extremely high local taxes on the resident population and businesses to compensate.
D.C. has some of the highest residential property tax rates in the region.
And high sales taxes and high income tax brackets. And this is the direct connection to the voting rights struggle. D.C. residents pay incredibly high taxes, but they can't even tax the people who work here, and they have no vote in the body that constrains their finances.
Which leads directly to the most prominent political issue, the federal voting rights struggle.
This is the historical and ongoing injustice. It's perfectly summarized by that license plate slogan, end taxation without representation.
And D.C. residents pay all federal taxes.
All of them. In fact, our sources noted that in fiscal year 2012 alone, D.C. residents and businesses paid $20.7 billion in federal taxes.
Which is more than the taxes collected from 19 separate states.
Yet they have no voting representation in the U.S. Congress.
So let's clarify what limited representation actually means in practice.
It means they elect a single non-voting delegate to the House of Representatives, currently Eleanor Holmes Norton.
And the delegate can do a lot of things. She can sit on committees, debate, introduce bills.
But, and this is the critical part, when a vote is called on the floor for final passage, she has to yield. She cannot cast a vote.
So if a bill is going through committee, she can influence it. But when it comes time for the nation's final decision, D.C. is silenced.
That's the key distinction. They are granted a voice, but no power on the floor.
The only federal voting rights D.C. residents have are for the presidency.
Yes, granted by the 23rd Amendment, which was ratified in 1961. This amendment grants the district presidential electors 3 votes, matching the least populous state, finally allowing Washingtonians to vote in a presidential election.
That level of disenfranchisement seems unbelievable to outsiders, and our sources confirm this ignorance is widespread.
It is shocking. A 2005 poll found that 78% of Americans were simply unaware that residents of Washington, D.C. have less representation in Congress than residents of the 50 states.
The city has done its best to educate the public, often using that iconic license plate slogan, but the fundamental legal reality is still opaque to most Americans.
And that frustration feeds directly into the statehood movement, which has gained significant traction.
And they've proposed a new name, Washington, Douglas Commonwealth.
Yes. The statehood movement has been a political force since the 1980s, gaining overwhelming local support. In the 2016 referendum, 85% of D.C. voters backed the idea of statehood.
And the proposed name is so deeply symbolic.
It is, combining the name of the first president with Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist who lived in D.C. and represented the struggle for full rights.
The argument for statehood is simple: full rights for full taxpayers. But the opposition to statehood is deeply rooted in the founding principles, or at least how those principles are interpreted today.
Right. Critics argue that the entire concept of a separate federal district, controlled exclusively by Congress, was established to prevent the national capital from being controlled by a single state or locale.
The Constitution specified that representation must come from the states.
And they claim that statehood would unfairly grant full Senate representation, two powerful senators, to a single compact city. They argue it would give undue influence to an urban center over rural states,
destroying the foundational concept of a non-state national capital.
That's the argument. And the statehood bills have tried to address this opposition directly.
How so?
The 2021 statehood bill attempted to neutralize this by proposing to shrink the remaining federal district, the federal enclave, to only encompass the core federal buildings around the National Mall, the White House, and the Capitol.
And the rest of the residential and commercial areas would become the new state?
Exactly. So a small, secure federal district would remain, and the residents would gain full statehood. But that legislation, of course, faces immense political hurdles in Congress.
Now we have to discuss one of the most remarkable and, frankly, concerning developments in the city's recent history, one that perfectly illustrates the precarious nature of this political company town.
The August 2025 federal intervention. This incident is the ultimate alarm bell for home rule advocates. It's a stark demonstration of Congress's ultimate authority over the city, which can be exercised through the executive branch.
So first, we need the crime context.
Right. D.C. has historically seen very high crime rates, peaking as the murder capital in the early 1990s, with 479 homicides in 1991. After a long decline, crime spiked sharply again in 2023, recording 274 homicides, a 20-year high.
And the sources highlight friction over the prosecution rate.
Yes. There was significant internal friction between residents, police, and the city government over the fact that a high rate of arrested offenders were not being prosecuted.
It stood at 56% by late 2023.
Nearly double the rate from a decade earlier. It was against this backdrop of elevated violence and perceived lack of enforcement that the federal government stepped in.
That's when President Trump acted, citing rampant crime.
Correct. On August 11th, 2025, the president invoked Section 740 of the Home Rule Act.
What did that do?
This declaration of a public safety emergency allowed the federal government to switch control of the Metropolitan Police Department from the city government to the Department of Justice. Federal law enforcement agencies and the D.C. National Guard were simultaneously deployed to patrol the city.
So was this truly unprecedented? Didn't Congress always have this power? What made this moment so alarming for local leaders compared to past interventions?
The power itself, granted by Section 740, is not unprecedented. It grants the president the power to temporarily take over the police force during emergency situations for a maximum of 30 days.
Not the use of it.
The use of it, the actual removal of the police force from local control due to internal city issues, was unprecedented since the inception of Home Rule in 1973.
So this was a massive political escalation.
It was huge. It wasn't just a squabble over the budget. It was the president removing control of the city's police force, a fundamental sovereign power.
Proving that the city is, at the end of the day, legally and functionally, a subsidiary of the federal government.
Subject to removal of rights at any time. It just underscores that, for all its democratic progress, D.C. is still governed at the pleasure of the federal power. The definition of a political company town.
Leaving the political turmoil for a moment, let's appreciate the physical space. The city's geography and architecture tell their own powerful story about permanence, design, and projection of authority.
It's a beautifully situated urban core, located in the Mid-Atlantic region, nestled on the east bank of the Potomac River.
And it borders Maryland to the northwest and East Montgomery and Prince George's counties, and Northern Virginia to the west and south.
Right, Arlington and Alexandria. This tri-state proximity defines its regional economy and commuting patterns.
The river systems here are central to its location, but D.C. was notorious for being a swampy, disease-ridden area initially, and that necessitated some extreme engineering.
That's right. The Potomac has two major tributaries here, the Anacostia River and Rock Creek. But the truly interesting feature is the hidden geography of Tiber Creek.
Tiber Creek.
Yes. This natural watercourse once flowed right through the heart of what became the National Mall. It was essential for early drainage. But as the city grew, the creek became associated with foul smells, stagnant water, and disease.
So what did they do?
As part of the massive post-Civil War redevelopment in the 1870s, Tiber Creek was completely enclosed underground. They rerouted it into a large sewer system.
So that act of civil engineering was pivotal for drying out the mall.
It was. It allowed the central monumental core to develop into the manicured space we know today. They literally married the swamp history of D.C.
And despite the high density of government buildings, D.C. is unexpectedly green, largely due to L'Enfant's foresight.
It is a powerhouse for green space. It often ranks at the top among major U.S. cities. The city boasts 7,464 acres of parks, making up about 20% of its land area.
And impressively, 99% of residents live within a 10-minute walk of a public park.
Yeah. L'Enfant and later the Macmillan Commission, they prioritized open space as essential for a healthy and aesthetically pleasing capital, echoing European traditions.
And Rock Creek Park is the crown jewel of that green design.
It is. Rock Creek Park is the largest park, spanning 9.3 miles through a stream valley in northwest D.C. Established in 1890, it holds the distinction of being the country's fourth oldest national park.
It provides vital ecological and recreational space right within the city limits.
It does. We should also mention the 446-acre U.S. National Arboretum in northeast D.C.
Home to the striking National Capitol columns.
Which are remnants of the original Capitol building that stand dramatically in a field. It's an amazing sight.
Now let's return to L'Enfant's blueprint, because his grid system defines everything about navigating the city.
His structure is brilliant in its order, which is why you rarely get truly lost once you understand it. The city is divided into four quadrants: northwest, northeast, southeast, and southwest.
And they all radiate from the single point of the U.S. Capitol building.
Which means every D.C. address must include that quadrant abbreviation, because otherwise, 4th Street might appear four different times.
And the naming system is completely consistent, which makes it easier than many cities to figure out.
It is the model of clarity. East-West streets are letters, starting from A, though A Street no longer really exists due to the expansion of the mall.
And North-South streets are numbered.
Right. And the signature diagonal avenues that carve through the grid, connecting the focal points, are named after the states of the Union.
And these avenues create numerous traffic circles, like DuPont Circle or Logan Circle,
which function as both scenic focal points and notorious traffic bottlenecks.
We have to highlight some key streets that have achieved iconic status simply due to their proximity to power.
Well, our source material notes Pennsylvania Avenue, which runs famously, almost ceremonially, between the White House and the Capitol.
And K Street.
The long-established hub for lobbying firms, think tanks, and trade groups. And then, of course, Constitution and Independence Avenues, which flank the National Mall and host most of the major government agencies and Smithsonian museums.
The architecture of D.C. is literally defined by law. And this is maybe the single most impactful piece of federal regulation on the city's physical form, the Height of Buildings Act of 1910.
This is the law that fundamentally separates D.C.'s skyline from every other major global capital. The act strictly limits the height of commercial and residential buildings based on the width of the adjacent street.
Generally capping them at 130 feet on commercial streets.
Which ensures that D.C. has this uniquely low and sprawling skyline.
And we must bust the popular myth. Buildings are not limited to the height of the Capitol dome.
That's the common misconception. They are limited by the 1910 Act street width formula. The tallest structure remains the Washington Monument, which stands at 555 feet and is the undisputed vertical apex of the city.
But the height restriction isn't just a quirk, is it? It has serious real-world consequences for the city's residents. The critique rightly points out we need to explore that.
We do. City leaders have continuously critiqued this height restriction, arguing it has artificially stifled the city's natural growth. Because D.C. cannot build vertically, it is forced to build horizontally.
And this contributes directly to a perpetual limited supply of affordable housing.
It drives up costs, and it exacerbates metropolitan sprawl and the intense traffic problems that plague the wider capital region.
So while cities like London or Paris manage density with mid-rise buildings, D.C.'s lack of vertical growth just pushes people further out,
complicating infrastructure planning and daily life.
Let's look at the architectural styles themselves. The dominant visual identity is designed to project power and permanence.
Absolutely. The visual identity of DC is overwhelmingly dominated by the neoclassical and classical revival styles. This was a direct result of the City Beautiful movement and the Macmillan Plan of 1901.
And this style, with its large columns, pediments, heavy stone facades, was chosen specifically to evoke the grandeur and stability of ancient Greece and Rome.
It defines the White House, the Capitol, the Lincoln and Jefferson memorials, and the Supreme Court.
But if you explore the city beyond the federal core, you find a surprising diversity and evolution of style.
You certainly do. The Library of Congress's Thomas Jefferson Building is a spectacular example of the intricate Beaux Arts style, while the Eisenhower Executive Office Building stands as an impressive example of French Second Empire architecture.
And as we move into the 20th and 21st centuries, DC embraces modernist contrast.
Exactly. The Washington Metro stations, with their iconic vaulted, exposed concrete ceilings, are a globally recognized example of brutalist architecture.
And newer developments, like the Wharf Waterfront or City Center DC, feature sleek, modernist glass and metal facades that contrast sharply with the neighboring marble structures.
It really shows the city's ability to evolve while still maintaining the federal core's classicism.
Finally, a quick note on DC's climate. We often hear about the swampy history, but what does that feel like today?
The climate is classified as temperate humid subtropical, or CFA. Winters are typically chilly with snow, averaging a major blizzard once every 4 to 6 years.
Like the record 28 inches that fell in 1922.
Right. Summers, however, are notoriously hot and humid. The historical swampy feeling manifests in this thick humidity. Heat indices regularly approach 100 degrees Fahrenheit, accompanied by frequent thunderstorms.
And what about hurricanes?
Due to the inland location, hurricanes typically weaken significantly by the time they reach DC, but flooding from the Potomac remains a historical threat, particularly to low-lying areas like Georgetown.
If the architecture defines the stage, the federal government defines the entire economic engine. Everything flows from the presence of Washington, DC as the capital, creating this immense concentrated wealth.
The economic concentration is unlike almost anywhere else in the nation. The data is staggering. DC consistently ranks at the very top among all U.S. states and territories for GDP per capita.
What did that actually look like in numbers?
Well, to give you a concrete figure, in 2016, DC's GDP per capita at over $160,000 was nearly 3 times greater than that of the second-ranked state, which was Massachusetts.
Wow. And that concentration of wealth and power points straight back to the government colossus. How large is the direct federal footprint?
As of 2022, a full 25% of all employed people in Washington, D.C. work directly for the federal government.
A quarter of the workforce.
Yes. And that's a massive, stable foundation for the economy. But the true impact, the multiplier effect, comes from the entire federal ecosystem that surrounds it.
Describe that ecosystem where power and money meet in the private sector.
It is the world's most robust influence economy. This second tier includes a massive concentration of high salary sectors. Major law firms specializing in regulatory and constitutional law, defense contractors, civilian contractors, nonprofits, trade groups.
And especially lobbying firms.
Especially them. These entities establish their headquarters nearby, often centralized in the K Street hub, specifically for proximity, access, and the ability to influence government decision-making on an hourly basis.
K Street is almost a character in DC mythology. It's where that revolving door between public service and private influence spins fastest.
Absolutely. K Street is shorthand for the professional influence industry. Its existence is a direct consequence of the immense amount of money the federal government spends and regulates.
So whether it's drafting legislation, lobbying for contracts, or influencing regulations.
The constant stream of power and money flowing through that ecosystem generates huge economic activity that benefits the city immensely, though unequally.
Beyond direct contracting and lobbying, the city is globally dominant in policy discussion and academic research.
DC is recognized worldwide as the think tank capital. It is home to 8% of the country's think tanks, including major players like the Heritage Foundation, the Brookings Institution, the Cato Institute, and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
And these groups conduct the research and fuel the policy debates that directly influence legislative and executive decisions.
Reinforcing DC's role as an intellectual nexus for global governance.
And the diplomatic footprint here solidifies DC's status as a world political and financial capital, not just a national one.
That's right. The city hosts the global headquarters of truly monumental international financial organizations, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, and the Organization of American States.
So DC is the hub for global financial governance, debt management, and economic policy, alongside its political role.
It is. Furthermore, DC hosts 177 foreign embassies, which maintain nearly 300 buildings throughout the city, many concentrated on Massachusetts Avenue, known informally as Embassy Row.
Reflecting its diplomatic density.
Exactly.
Shifting to the private sector that doesn't directly deal with influence, what are the local economic engines outside of policy and government contracting?
Tourism is the second largest industry, after the federal government itself. In 2019, D.C. saw 24.6 million tourists, including nearly 2 million international visitors.
And they were collectively spending $8.15 billion.
A huge amount. This industry supports massive sectors like lodging, food and beverage, entertainment, and transportation. It helps diversify the economy away from purely federal dependence, though, of course, tourism is highly sensitive to political or security events.
And what about traditional finance and corporate headquarters? Does DC function as a financial center?
It does, increasingly. DC has a growing financial presence. It's ranked as the 8th most competitive financial center globally and the 4th most competitive in the U.S. according to the 2023 Global Financial Centers Index.
So while it's not New York?
It's not New York, but it is home to major companies like Fannie Mae, Amtrak, Danaher Corporation, and major internationally influential law firms like Hogan Lovells. It's a highly diversified, centralized metropolitan economy, driven almost entirely by the presence of a single non-taxable entity, the federal government.
Let's move past the economic engines and into the true heart of Washington, the culture and the community. This is where the story gets really rich, unexpected, and often resistant to the gravity of the federal city.
It's essential to look beyond the political narrative because DC has a deep and important history as a center for the arts and performance, a national cultural center in its own right.
The performing arts are concentrated around some legendary institutions that are themselves tied to the federal idea.
The John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, located on the Potomac, is the jewel of the city's performing arts. It's home to the National Symphony Orchestra, the Washington National Opera, and the Washington Ballet.
And crucially, it is the site of the annual Kennedy Center Honors and the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor.
Ceremonies that are frequently attended by the President and Congress, cementing its role as a national cultural institution.
And DC has institutions that speak directly to the nation's history.
Absolutely. We have to mention the historic Ford's Theater, the site of Lincoln's assassination, which continues to operate both as a working theater and a profound museum dedicated to Lincoln's life and legacy.
And the National Theater in downtown,
which opened in 1835, is the second longest continuously operating theater in the nation, right after the Walnut Street Theater in Philadelphia.
Now, perhaps one of the most culturally significant areas historically is the U Street Corridor and Shaw, often called Black Broadway. This area highlights the specific identity of Washingtonians outside the political sphere.
This was a vital cultural center, especially during the early 20th century. During the Jazz Age and the Black Renaissance in D.C., which coincided with the larger Harlem Renaissance, U Street was one of the largest and most prosperous Black communities in the U.S.
The stomping ground for jazz legends like D.C. native Duke Ellington.
And John Coltrane and Miles Davis, who played at famous venues like the Howard Theater and Lincoln Theater. It was a thriving, self-sustaining community before the riots of 1968 altered its trajectory.
But if D.C. has a true native sound, one that defines its unique flavor, it has to be go-go. We need to dedicate some time to this distinct genre.
Go-go is profoundly unique to DC. It's the city's indigenous music genre, a post-funk, percussion-driven flavor of rhythm and blues.
Popularized by the DC bandleader Chuck Brown in the late 1970s.
That's right. And what makes it distinct is the emphasis on continuous, complex, auxiliary percussion and call and response interaction between the band and the audience.
So unlike many genres, go-go is structured around endless improvisation and audience participation,
which makes it highly specific to live performance. It defines the sound of Washington, D.C. neighborhood culture.
And for music aficionados interested in the counterculture, D.C.'s contribution to indie and punk culture is massive, globally influential.
It is often overlooked in favor of the federal narrative, but the D.C. hardcore punk scene flourished starting in the 1970s, particularly in neighborhoods like Adams Morgan. This scene was founded on a distinct ideology, the straight edge movement, and a fierce DIY ethos.
And the DC-based label Discord Records.
formed by Ian MacKay, the frontman of Fugazi, was cited in our sources as one of the most crucial independent labels in the genesis of 1980s punk and 1990s indie rock. This local anti-establishment culture runs directly counter to the K Street machine.
Let's move to cuisine, because DC has quietly become one of the country's best dining cities, and it's home to some unique staples you won't find anywhere else.
The city's culinary scene has achieved global recognition. Due to 20th century immigration, particularly from East Africa, DC is known globally for having excellent Ethiopian cuisine.
And the Shaw neighborhood is often nicknamed Little Ethiopia.
The concentration and quality are truly world-class.
And what are the classic comforting DC staples that are mandatory eating for anyone trying to understand the local flavor?
You have to try three things. First, the half smoke.
This isn't a hot dog.
No, it's a signature sausage that is half beef, half pork smoked, and usually served with chili, mustard, and onions on a hot dog bun.
Second, mumbo sauce.
A distinct, sweet, sticky, reddish-orange, barbecue-like condiment, often served over fried wings or french fries. A true DC creation.
And third, the jumbo slice pizza.
A ridiculously large New York-style slice with its roots in late-night Adams Morgan food culture. It speaks to the late-night character of the city's dense nightlife.
And we can't talk about DC food without mentioning the iconic Ben's Chili Bowl. It's more than a restaurant. It's a historical anchor.
Ben's Chili Bowl on U Street since 1958 is a true cultural landmark. It became renowned for remaining open and serving the community during the 1968 race riots,
providing a peaceful escape and sustenance when much of the city shut down.
Right. It's famous for its half smokes and chili dogs and has attracted presidents and celebrities for decades. And this local flavor extends to fine dining, too. DC has been recognized as having the most Michelin-starred restaurants per capita of any U.S. city.
Which solidifies its place among the nation's best for dining.
Absolutely.
Finally, we must analyze the demographic shifts, because they reveal the intense social and economic changes happening beneath the surface of the federal city. Changes that directly contrast with the massive wealth we just discussed.
The historical context is vital here. DC has always had a large black population, consistently around 30% between 1800 and 1940. Following the civil rights era and the expansion of the federal government, it reached its peak.
Becoming a majority black city, nicknamed Chocolate City, at 70% in 1970.
Right, but that demographic profile has changed dramatically in the last few decades, often linked to gentrification.
It has. Since 1970, the black population has declined, partly due to African Americans moving to the surrounding suburbs, but it was significantly accelerated by rapid economic development and gentrification.
A high-profile study by the National Community Reinvestment Coalition found that DC has experienced more aggressive gentrification than any other U.S. city.
With 40% of its neighborhoods affected between 2000 and 2013.
Yes. And between 2000 and 2010 alone, the non-Hispanic white population increased by over 31%, while the black population decreased by over 11%.
Yet, even with this influx of new, highly paid residents and a high median household income, the poverty rate is shockingly high. It illustrates a sharp internal economic inequality.
That is the ultimate inequality paradox in DC. The city boasts a very high median household income, $92,266 in 2019, and a high per capita income, higher than any of the 50 states.
Which is driven by the concentrated federal ecosystem job.
Right. Yet its poverty rate stood at 14.7% in 2019. That figure, nearly one in seven residents, reflects profound internal economic inequality and displacement.
We also see significant immigration.
Major sources from El Salvador, Ethiopia, and Guatemala, resulting in strong cultural concentrations like the Salvadoran community in Mount Pleasant.
As a planned city, infrastructure is key to how DC functions, but much of the existing public transit system is actually the result of fierce public resistance to highway planning in the 1960s.
This is a great piece of urban history known as the Freeway Revolts. In the 1960s, planners proposed extensive interstate highways that would have carved directly through established DC neighborhoods.
But public opposition, led by local activists, successfully blocked the construction of much of this proposed highway system,
which would have devastated historic communities. Because of these revolts, Interstate 95, the major East Coast highway, bends around the district, forming the eastern portion of the Capitol Beltway.
And the major success of that fight was the redirection of funds, which redefined how Washingtonians get around.
Crucially, a portion of that proposed highway funding was legally redirected toward public transportation infrastructure.
Specifically, the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority, or the Metro.
Right. This anti-highway stance laid the groundwork for DC's current public transit reliance and its highly walkable layout,
which is substantial compared to other U.S. cities.
It is. 37% of DC commuters use public transit to get to work, which is the second highest rate nationally after New York City.
And the Washington Metro, which began operations in 1976.
It's the second busiest rapid transit system in the U.S. and is known worldwide for its iconic minimalist, brutalist style vaulted ceilings and extensive network that operates mostly as a deep-level subway downtown.
Beyond trains, DC is highly accessible even without a car, directly benefiting from the rejection of the highway paradigm.
DC ranks as the fifth most walkable city in the country, with neighborhoods like U Street, DuPont Circle, and Adams Morgan considered highly walkable and transit-rich.
It also has one of the largest and most successful bicycle sharing systems in the United States.
Capital Bike Share, yeah. It further enhances its public transportation ecosystem.
Now, transportation out of the city is also unique because none of the major regional airports are actually located within DC borders. Another point that speaks to the federal district's size constraints.
That's right. The three major airports, Reagan National, Dulles International, and Baltimore, Washington, are all in the surrounding jurisdictions of Virginia and Maryland.
Reagan National is the closest, right across the Potomac.
Yes, in Arlington. It provides primarily domestic and short-haul flights. Dulles, further out in Virginia, is the largest and handles the majority of the region's international traffic.
Moving from physical infrastructure to cultural infrastructure, DC is synonymous with the Smithsonian. It is essentially the world's largest, most concentrated museum complex.
And its accessibility is paramount to its national mission. The Smithsonian Institution is federally funded, and all of its official museums offer free admission to the public.
The sheer scale is just difficult to grasp.
It is. DC is home to 8 of the 28 most visited U.S. museums. In 2022, for instance, the National Museum of Natural History was ranked the 5th most visited museum globally.
That concentration of knowledge and history is unbelievable. Name some of the diversity within the Smithsonian umbrella.
The diversity is immense. You have the vast collections of the National Museum of Natural History, the National Air and Space Museum, the powerful National Museum of African American History and Culture,
the National Museum of the American Indian, and even the National Zoo.
And it's important to note that the National Gallery of Art, while owning major American and European collections, is not technically part of the Smithsonian Institution.
Though it is also federally owned and free to the public.
Right. And you also have non-Smithsonian institutions like the Holocaust Memorial Museum and the popular International Spy Museum.
All these institutions converge around the physical and symbolic heart of the city, the National Mall.
The mall is the grand centerpiece of L'Enfant's original plan. A nearly 2-mile park stretching from the Capitol to the Lincoln Memorial. It serves a dual, essential role.
It's a ceremonial space, home to the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool.
But it is also the national stage for political expression. It hosts every major political protest, concert, and event in American history, allowing citizens a prominent space to exercise their First Amendment rights.
And just south of the mall, you get that cluster of memorials around the Tidal Basin, which offers a powerful contrast of beauty and history.
The Tidal Basin is a human-made reservoir created to help flush out the Potomac River and prevent silt buildup. Today, it's most famous for hosting the annual National Cherry Blossom Festival, when millions of blossoms bloom along its edges.
And it's surrounded by iconic monuments that represent different eras of American progress and struggle.
The Jefferson Memorial, the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, and the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Memorial.
And finally, D.C. is the custodian of the foundational documents of the United States.
That responsibility rests with the National Archives, located just north of the mall. It houses the original Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, drawing millions of visitors.
A connection to the origins of the Republic.
Exactly. And on Capitol Hill sits the Library of Congress, the largest library complex in the world, with a massive collection exceeding 173 million items, formerly serving Congress, but functioning as the de facto national library.
This deep dive has fully exposed DC as a city of planned, inescapable contrasts. You have the permanence and gravity of L'Enfant's classical architecture, enshrined by the 1910 Hyde Act, running right up against the urgent modernist needs of a sprawling, diverse, and dynamic metropolis.
A metropolis that must continuously fight for basic self-determination.
Yes.
And that tension is the thread running through every aspect of the city. We've seen the massive economic influence derived from federal spending, the city's status as a global hub for policy and diplomacy, and the incredible culture it's produced.
Yet that power is continuously balanced by the historical legacy of the Organic Act, the loss of the city's self-governance, and the perpetual local struggle for a simple political voice in the halls of Congress.
The 1846 retrocession, the 1871 consolidation that stripped local rights, the partial home rule of 1973, and the recent dramatic 2025 federal police takeover.
They all demonstrate that the relationship between the capital and the nation is far from settled, regardless of how permanent the marble feels.
Right. The architecture projects eternal power, but the political rights of its citizens are subject to temporary whim.
So, as a final thought for you, the learner, consider this. Given the original political compromise that created D.C., the persistent lack of voting representation in Congress, and the recent powerful instance of a federal takeover of its local police force,
is Washington, D.C. fundamentally designed to serve the nation over its residents? In an age of information, is the District of Columbia truly a self-governing city, or is it perpetually the ultimate political company town, defined only by the will of those who commute in from beyond the Beltway?
The implications of that answer resonate throughout every neighborhood, regardless of the constitutional arguments made two centuries ago. Something profound to mull over as you see that license plate slogan again. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the architecture of power and identity that is Washington, D.C.
Until next time.